Hey, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jeff Ponce, another Baseball America Prospect podcast, as we do every week, as we get every Wednesday. This week's a little bit more normal. Jeff has not been traveling. Jeff has gotten to see real live minor league baseball in the Northeast, not just in Florida now.
Yeah,
I've gotten to see real live baseball as well. But Jeff, great to see you. And I have to ask, like, you got to see one of the teams. I wouldn't say one of the most talented teams in the minors, because I don't think the Woo Sox are that, but they do have one of the best duos that we've seen. Yes. How was it to see Marcelo Meyer and Roman Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was one of those where you're there, I've seen these guys a whole bunch, and in some ways sort of felt like, you know, the swan song, like these guys are probably going to be up in the big leagues at some point pretty soon, whether it's days, weeks, months, it's not going to be years. These are players that are ready to contribute in some way, shape, or form. And I think if positionally the Red Sox weren't as deep as they are, they probably would have been up already. And, you know, Anthony has done nothing but hit. He's dealt with some injuries. He had the shoulder thing, so they had him DHing, which obviously couldn't have been that serious if he's still swinging a bat, right? And then had a foot thing over the weekend, missed a couple of games.
Fouled the ball off in the first, stayed in the game till the fifth, but then did leave and didn't play the doubleheader.
And then, of course, you know, still made the hot sheet, and as did Meyer, I think, the last 2 weeks as well. So,
Played center field before, was playing center field in the game that he bruised his foot. So the shoulder thing has gotten better enough for him to do that too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there could be a spot there in the Red Sox outfield if they decide to eventually move away from Rafaela and, you know, Duran or whoever patrols center. I think that's probably where they would go first.
I'll interject again. I'm being annoying today. But Duran, they have said, is now not playing any more center. So, So basically they want him to focus on being basically, they feel like gold glove caliber in left. So.
That's kind of interesting.
or at least I saw a story about that. So I'm now checking to make sure that I'm not wrong on that. But
because I guess that pushes Anthony back into center field long term, which is his best defensive position. But I've always kind of thought he would be a corner outfielder eventually. But regardless, both of those guys looked really good. Just controlling the strike zone, making lots of contact, loud contact. You know, I think this is probably the best that I've seen Marcelo Meyer. Just look clean in the field, swing look good. Physically looks a little bit leaner than he has the last couple of years as well. And, you know, hopefully that leads to some durability, which is, I think, been the biggest question mark with him. It's a beautiful left-handed swing. You have a really powerful left-handed swing, just not as pretty in Roman Anthony. But makes a ton of contact. I think his walk to strikeout ratio in AAA right now is even. And he's still only 20 years old. I think that's the craziest thing about Anthony. He doesn't turn 21 for another 2 weeks. I think it's the 13th or the 14th of May. So he's still incredibly young, and I think there's no reason to rush him. But at the same time, he looks as ready for his major league debut as any player in the minor league.
There's also at baseballamerica.com right now a good piece that Ellie did for us on his StatCast standouts about Roman Anthony and just how impressive analytically his data is this year as well. And just to kind of finish the circle, Duran played center in the first week of the season and is basically in one game in right and has only played left field since then. Christian Campbell actually has four starts in center, and Jaron Duran only has one and has not done it since late March. So it does seem like that they really are going to say, Jaron Duran, you're a left fielder. Obviously, not every day, but I would say that, you know, with the platoon, that Willier Abreu is the right fielder. And it does seem like if Anthony's going to come up, it would be more in center field probably than anywhere else right now. And he is playing some center, as we noted, in AAA between all these injuries that he's been battling with. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. Today, we have... Well, you know, I would say it's a little bit of a depressing topic, because we are going to talk about two teams who, at the big league level, the 2025 season's pretty much already over. You know, there's still a lot of games to be played. There's still a lot to happen, but there is no scenario that you can get the Colorado Rockies from where they are right now. I saw a stat last week that was amazing, which is that in mid-April, the Rockies were already further back from the fourth place team in the NL West than any team finished out of fifth, you know, fifth out of fourth last year, other than the White Sox. So yeah, you know, that's kind of really depressing. They've been really bad. The White Sox, who were really bad last year, are really bad again. But the question that we wanted to ask today, and we'll spin it positively, is if you look at these two organizations, you look at these two teams, you look at their farm systems, which team has a path to pulling out of the utter dregs of the basement? And I'll kind of pose that to you, Jeff. If you said, hey, I've got to predict that one of these teams is going to show signs of life in 27, 28, you know, 26 is probably asking a lot because they're both on pace to well over 100 losses probably, you know, this year. So it's hard to imagine that you're going to go from, you know, 55 and something last, you know, next this year to, you know, the goal then would be 70 next year. But, you know, does one of these teams have a more promising future to you, a path to getting back to respectability before too long?
Yeah, I think for a few reasons, it's the White Sox. Some of it is their doing. Some of it is just circumstances of being an AL Central team versus an NL West team, which is a very tough division. You know, you can argue that you may have two of the four best teams in baseball in that division, in the Dodgers and in the Padres. You then have to contend with a Giants organization that seems to kind of be headed in the right direction. We'll see how things sort of turn, but it is always competitive. It's a tough place to play. I think you look at where the Rockies are and who they have to go up against. And oh, by the way, the Diamondbacks, you know, have a winning record this year and have been a pretty good,
really solid.
Yeah. Organization.
They have a solid team, not just like they have a winning record, but like one that looks sustainable.
Yeah, and they get Ketel Marte back as well, probably later this week. So that kind of changes their dynamic. They're pretty deep. I wouldn't be shocked if they finish ahead of the Giants. I know the Giants are like 19-10 right now, which is great to see. But, you know, it's a really tough competitive division. And I think that puts them behind the eight ball, number one. Number two, in terms of processes and how they're attacking things outside of the draft and outside of international free agency, trades, free agency, they haven't done well in terms of the free agents that they brought in. They have a long history dating back many, many moons, you know, beyond 10 years in terms of just a lot of bad signings. They've never been able to sort of hack or figure out some sort of sustainable approach to pitching. Particularly at Coors, despite the humidor and all these other things, these other factors, they haven't really been able to figure that out. And I think it's because there's never really been any change in the front office. Even the White Sox have seen slight changes in the last few years in that front office. The other part of it is the White Sox are much more aggressive in terms of trading veterans out at peak value, good times in their value, looking at how much time is, you know, Garrett Crochet have left on their contract, whatever it might be. And then went going trading for more players and acquiring high level prospects. They've probably done that as well as just about anybody in the major, you know, in the major leagues, frankly, in terms of actually turning a lot of those picks into players. So they've drafted at the top of the draft. They haven't made bad picks, I don't think. But have backfilled and have some talented players that are on the cusp of the major leagues. And this year was kind of a change. There's even some positional prospects like Caleb Bonnemer, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that I think might actually be a good drafted high school positional player by the White Sox, which is a very rare occurrence. They have a lot of positional depth. They obviously have that stacked rotation in Birmingham where like kind of all of their top pitching prospects are. But yeah, it's interesting.
To go off what you said with the Rockies, and I said this when we did our Rockies deep dive, the thing that scares me about them, the thing that concerns me is it's kind of something that you talked about here, but that I don't see there. It seems like every year is spent in a goal of trying to get to 75 to 80, you know, 75 win team that hopefully, if everything breaks right, can get to 82 wins, right? Like, and what I mean by that is that when they have a lot of players who they've had some highs and lows, but they're players who the highs are that they're a 3 WAR player, 3.5 WAR player. And that's probably the year that everything breaks right for them. And then they hold on to that guy. And then a year or two later, he's kind of returned to his actual C level. And you're like, oh, he's actually a 1 WAR player. He's a 0.5 WAR player. He's a 1.5 WAR player. And so what I mean by that is this, okay, to take just a couple of examples, Nolan Jones, right? That seemed like a really nice low cost pickup. The Guardians traded Nolan Jones away. The Rockies pick him up, and he had very solid season for Colorado. But I would say that a lot of the underlying metrics to it were less promising than the actual production was. And so Nolan Jones had that basically one kind of like really good season. The next year he kind of returns, he crashes back down to earth. And what ends up happening, they end up trading Nolan Jones back to the Guardians in a very kind of minor kind of, we'll trade one player for your player kind of move. They kind of made Ryan McMahon, who's a solid player, who's been a solid player, but Ryan McMahon's kind of become like a cornerstone guy for them. And that's not a cornerstone type guy. Brenton Doyle is a solid player, but Brenton Doyle, again, that's the guy who should hopefully be the fourth or fifth best player in your lineup, not cornerstone guy. There's just a lot. Michael Toglia is their everyday first baseman. Michael Toglia had never had a stretch in the minors where you would say this is like a guy who you want to build, have in the middle of your lineup or anything like that. I'm not saying he didn't have stretches where you said he could play in the majors, but he's not just playing in the majors. He's like a guy who they're kind of really relying on. And I just I'm not trying to bang on him, but like to go back to the example I was saying, like last year, he was a 2 WAR player for them, but he hit 218, 311, 456. It was, I will provide power, but all the other underlying metrics are really concerning. The strikeout rate was concerning, all these things where I'm not saying he's going to be as bad as he's been in the first month of the season, but your upside on him is still pretty low. And that's where we talked a little bit about this in the deep dive, but like if the concern that I would say that I have, if you're trying to lay this out with the Rockies, is I look at this team and we can absolutely put Chase Dollander in the group of players where you're like, okay, I know he's had a very rough, he's allowed 8 home runs in his, I think, his first 4 starts, and that's pitching in Colorado is never fun. But if you put him in kind of the cornerstone kind of guys you're building around, the real problem you have is like, I don't know, like Ezekiel Tovar fits in that to me, position players wise. I think they're going to say that Jordan Beck and Brenton Doyle are those guys, but I would say that those fit more as complementary pieces around cornerstones than they are cornerstone guys. And I really do struggle still to kind of point to and say, this is how this is all going to coalesce into something. You hit on it when you said, they don't sell high on players, generally. They don't say, this guy has played as well as he could possibly play this year. We're not going anywhere next year. This is the perfect time to cash out on that player and then build for the future, right? Like, and example I would give with that, we could talk about Crochet, but Crochet is a weird one, right? Like, you don't get those every year. But Eric Fetty last year was 100% to me an example of this, where the White Sox do a very astute signing of Eric Fetty as a free agent coming back from Asia. He ends up being really good. And instead of saying, look at this, we've just got to see if we can ride this out as much as we can, it was like, hey, this is the perfect time to trade and try to cash in on that. That's where I think it's important that we flip to it. Like, when we look on the prospect side and you do our Rockies list, we both know the White Sox, prospects pretty well. I feel like there's a pretty strong distinction right now between those two farm systems. Obviously, a lot of it on the White Sox side is guys they traded for. It's Braden Montgomery. It's Kyle Teal. It's, pitchers that they've traded for. you know, as pop-ups like Grant Taylor, you know, and all, but I just feel a lot better about where their farm system is right now than I do about Colorado's. Am I right? Or would you, you know, again, you do our Rockies list. Am I wrong?
Yeah. I just think the high end impact is there with guys like Schultz, Hagen Smith. I think Braden Montgomery of all of their positional players might have the highest upside. Edgar Cuero, Kyle Teal gives them like multiple catchers that I think could be primary catchers at the big league level. And then they have like a lot of like fill in guys, you know, as well. I think like where the Rockies' strength lies is I do think they have better depth. I think you start to look deeper into the system, there's more interesting upside guys. I think they do a better job overall and historically have of drafting hitters. We've talked about the White Sox deficiencies there. I think they do a really good job in the international market, better than the White Sox, who tend to send a lot of hitters from Cuba for whatever reason. But you have just a lot of interesting younger lower level hitters. The issue is not a lot of these guys have ever gotten the polish that they need, and sort of how the Rockies roll out guys in their debuts, they kind of slow roll them for a couple of years and they kind of marinate, like playing a couple times a week, kind of riding the bus between Albuquerque and Denver. And then all of a sudden they'll earn a full-time spot or they fizzle out. It's kind of a weird approach. For the life of me, I don't understand why they're not more aggressive in moving out certain players that they know aren't going to necessarily play full-time roles for them early and trying to upgrade to other players. Like there's just, this is the lowest period of the Rockies organization. And they still seem kind of rudderless, despite, like I said, I do think they scout pretty well at the amateur level, whether it's domestically or internationally. It's just a matter of once those players are in, the development paths are very strange. Like Adel Amador getting called up last year really didn't make any sense when he was really going through it in Hartford. And then it took a while for him to kind of readjust and look pretty good. So, yeah, I mean, like, I think there's things that you can credit the Rockies on. I do think that you hit the nail on the head with Tovar and Doyle. They're not players you build around, but it's a good start in terms of like the middle of the you know, up the middle. Yeah. You're very strong
defenders who help you hit something.
And I think particularly in that park, that is helpful. It's just they've never gone out and gotten a truly big bat. Chris Bryant, when he hit free agency, everybody knew that it was going to be a bad signing for whoever signed him. They've never gone out and gotten a big middle of the order bat. They certainly haven't developed one as of yet. That's what the hope was with Charlie Condon. And, you know, now it looks like they overpaid for a player that they might've been able to get a better version of in Nick Kurtz, who's already made his major league debut. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see how that shakes out. I do think Charlie Condon and Chase Dolander and how they look when we come back to this in 5 years is going to have a big impact on, you know, whether we're wrong about the Rockies here or not, but that's really what they need to sort of hit. Where the White Sox, I think you just have a lot of other options in terms of how things could shake out. Even talent on the major league roster right now, it's a surprisingly interesting young rotation. They did a really good job of picking Shane Smith. So far, he looks awesome.
I will say, if you and I are talking, we can't not mention Shane Smith looks like one of the best Rule 5 picks of the 21st century. And I say that, like, I feel comfortable in saying that. Like, there are very few Rule 5 picks who have had a stretch like this. I always say with Rule 5 picks, you're not looking in the long term. What they do for you in year one is incredibly important. There's not many examples of players who were unproductive in year one and then go on to be productive for the team that picked them. Shane Smith is the ace of the staff from the moment he arrived as a Rule 5 pick.
Him and Davis Martin. I want to also shout out Davis, who's also been really, really good. he took a big step forward. There were some signs at the end of last year. And then, you know, Burke and Cannon, 24, 25 years old, getting some experience. It's kind of interesting. Like, they have something there, and they've done okay developing pitchers. I mean, we have seen a couple.
Lineup there is a disaster still.
Yeah. But the lineup.
They are a, like, at the big league level, yes, they were horrendous last year, and nothing has significantly changed on that this year.
It's bad. It's just a matter of, you know, can they trade, you know, Louis Robert and, you know, maybe get something interesting, figure something out. They do need hitters.
They need him to produce to where he's a useful trade piece.
Yeah, it's kind of accurate.
I mean, because right now he's come back and he's really struggled coming off of, you know, he's been injury prone, but like, it's really hard to package it right now and say, hey, you know what your successful team really needs? This guy who has a negative war right now.
Yeah.
That's
you're right.
Take everything to another level.
Yeah. And it's two club option, $20 million options after this year. So the money isn't exactly cheap. So he's got to pay for it, but we'll see. We're thinking positive here. We'll throw it out there. Obviously, he hasn't produced as of yet, but we'll see what happens. And then, you know, they do have some hitters here, you know, there's not a lot of high end.
So
do you think that's where the Rockies maybe have the advantage? Is they do have a better crop of positional talent that's in the high minors or in the major leagues that's young. But there's no one that's a superstar. And yeah.
The problem with that is that they're the worst team in baseball. And when we talk about their hitters, you can't rank their hitting prospects higher than probably maybe in the 15 to 20 range of the top of the 30 orgs. You know, you look like, we were just talking about Marcelo Meyer and Roman Anthony. And again, I know that that's top tier, but right there, if you said, would you rather have that or the Red Sox hitting prospects, you'd rather have Meyer and Anthony. And we haven't thrown Christian Campbell in there. Just look in their division, right? Like, would you rather have Dalton Rushing and Jose DePaula and Zahir Hope? Like the Dodgers, you would absolutely prefer the Dodgers hitters.
Yes.
Would you rather have Leo DeVries? I know the Padres system is thin, but it starts with Leo DeVries.
Yeah.
You'd rather have Leo DeVries than anyone that the Rockies have.
Yeah. It would be, I would say, like the duo you'd have to go with would be Condit and Carrig.
Compare them to the D-backs, right? Would you rather have the Rockies top 10 or Rockies hitters or the D-backs hitting prospects? Crisantes, you know, Walschmidt, Caldwell.
See, I think like you got Condon, Carrig, Yankeel Fernandez, who's still much younger than people realize and is hitting for power. Robert Kalas, Zach Veen, who's had a resurgence this year.
I'm asking, one would you rather have? Them or D-backs?
I think with the D-backs, I'd rather have the Rockies guys. Okay.
And I would say the Giants' strength is pitching. They don't really have a whole lot of hitting. I would say that you definitely want the Rockies' hitting prospects over the Giants' hitting.
Yeah, I think it's probably more like 15 than 20.
Okay, but it's 15, right?
There's a lot of 50s. There's no, like, the big thing is Condon. You know, if Condon is a 60, if Condon returns, he's healthy, and all of a sudden he starts to put that stuff to rest, that changes the dynamic.
They need him to be their Nick Kurtz.
He's a huge, you know, mystery box right now. That's how he could be a 30. He could be a 60. Like, there's so many outcomes that seem to be able, you know, possible here with the injuries and some of the other nonsense that, you know, scouts have thrown out there, et cetera, about the swing. So yeah, you know, we'll see how it all comes to fruition. It's just, it's so hard to know.
So, but this is, and I think this is the way to put a bow on it. I have one more White Sox thing I want to talk about, but you just said about how they haven't went out and gotten a hitter. But the thing that amazes me probably to no end is whenever the Rockies have been good or whenever the Rockies have been bad, but interesting, right? Because they've had some years where I would describe them as fun bad over their years, right? Where they can't pitch, But you know what? They're going to hit a bazillion homers. They're going to lose 10-9. 10-9 can be interesting as a loss. But what they haven't had lately, who's the last really good homegrown? Like, this is a team that had Todd Helton. This is a team that had Matt Holliday. This is a team that had, you know, guys like Vinny Castilla and Dante Bichette, you know, in the middle of their lineup. And we could go, you know, like there's, but they haven't really produced. They've produced complimentary hitters, but there's no one who would say, like, where we're having that fun debate now where it's like, okay, he's good, but, you know, I don't know if he's really the 330 home run guy that he is in Coors. They haven't had any of those guys in a while now, have they? Charlie Blackman, yeah. You know, last is kind of like the end of that.
Yeah, era. I would say because they had, you know, Blackman, Arenado certainly fit into that conversation. Obviously, you know, we didn't get his prime years outside of Coors, but still fine. Trevor Story, I think, is maybe on that line. Certainly had some great years. Oh, yeah. Looks like he's kind of back a little bit. I'd argue it's probably Story.
I would say, but that's been a while now.
Yeah, it has. Because, you know, that's been about 10 years. And, you know, that crop of Rogers and McMahon and some of those guys, it just, the promise early really didn't come to fruition. You know, obviously, Rogers got DFA'd, I think, so.
But right, that's the thing to me that is, you know, like, again, when you say, like, okay, the Rockies are always gonna have trouble developing pitching, but the fact that we are now, you know, Trevor Story was there much more recently than 10 years ago, but he came up 10 years ago, basically, or, you know, almost 10 years ago now, where that's him and Arenado are the last, like, middle of the order type bats that they've produced homegrown, where you're like, that's what I expect Colorado to be able to produce pretty regularly. Because we know it's a pretty favorable hitting environment. But before we wrap this up, I did want to ask with the White Sox, one that we've talked about a little bit, but is it time to get really worried about White Sox shortstop / third base prospect Colson Montgomery, who had a rough year last year, 2024, in Charlotte, which is a great hitter's park. And so far this year, I just put the numbers up there. It's 149, 223, 255 with a 42% strikeout rate so far. You know, he's slid down our top 100. We're getting ready to do another top 100 update. I think that it's fair to say he's probably going to slide further. But what's kind of your viewpoint on, I mean, is it time to not say it's over with, you know, the Colson Montgomery, but is it time to say, there's more reason to be skeptical than it is that this is a top prospect?
Yeah, he's really going through it right now. And it's unusual. I think just build on what he was. He has that year in AAA. It was pretty bad last year, you know, but was young at 22. And it was really bad in the context of, like, where he was hitting. I dug into the numbers a little bit. And I think there's maybe some reasons for optimism. And the pessimistic side, the question you have to ask is this fixable or not? So on the positive, so far this year, his average EV is way up. It was 85.8 last year. It's 89 this year. It's only 51 batted ball events. So it's not fully stabilized yet, but we're about 19 to 20 balls in play away from that. He's got a 115.3 max, which is much higher than last year's 113.8. Really, really good number. Launch angles are up. Hard hit rate is up. So under the hood, what else is the issue, right? Well, his chase rate is up 27% year over year. It was a 25.2 last year. It's 34.6 this year. 27% is a huge jump. In O swing, the swing rate isn't even that far up. It's 45.5% to 48.4% this year. His zone swing, though, which was pretty low at 65.8%, you want to see something in the mid 70s to like 80% is really nice to see. So it's, that was always a little low. It's even lower this year at 62.5%. But here's where it gets really messy. He's swinging outside of the zone at a significantly higher clip. 27%, okay? his O contact is down from 48.3% to 32.4%. So he's swinging at way more pitches out of the zone, and he's missing at a significantly higher rate out of the zone while swinging at less strikes, despite the fact that he actually has a higher this year than he did last year. But it's right in line with last year, 84.1% last year, 84.8% this year. So his drop in contact rate from 74.2 last year to 65.8, you can almost point directly at his swing decisions. His swing decisions went from being above average to being terrible. Now he's found a little bit more power. I don't know if that's going hand in hand and being more aggressive. We do see guys sometimes hit for more power when they get more aggressive. But I think the concern here is he's just not identifying balls and strikes, and he's attacking pitches that he should not be swinging at. He's done it before. I don't see why he can't do it again, but he's gone away from a certain approach, and I don't know the reason why. But it's staggering when you look at the numbers. You look at the data, and it's very clear that there's been a significant approach change, and it hasn't been for the better, and it's led to bad swings outside of the zone at unhittable pitches. And it's too bad, because if he could kind of marry that zone swing with better approach, he is hitting the ball a lot harder at better angles. So there is some stuff to look at and say, this is good. But there's one sort of glaring wart here, like in the middle of his face, that you're like, oh man, like, we got to get that fixed.
When he was a kind of on his way up as kind of an elite, you know, middle infield prospect, producing at younger than the levels that he was at, as a shortstop, who again always had been concerned that he's eventually going to be a third baseman or a second baseman, probably third. But the thing that stands out with that is that, like you said, it was 13% walk rate in 2022, right? The walk rates were like that in 2023. Like, it was this ability to marry plate discipline and power. And now we're talking about this year, it's like a 7% walk rate and a 42% strikeout rate, where that's kind of disappeared effectively as he's climbed the ladder to AAA. And that is where you say, okay, he's still young. There's still hope that he can maybe get back to that in some way. But I do kind of look at it and say, he is more suspect than prospect at this point, from a standpoint of like, I mean, when we do our update on the top 100, it's hard for me to argue he's a top 100 prospect right now. If the White Sox said, hey, we're looking to make a trade, what about Colson Montgomery as the cornerstone of that deal? I don't think that starts a conversation with anybody right now. Where if you said, you know, and when I say that, like, again, it's not like the White Sox are going to be going out there and going to be trading prospects to acquire big league talent in 2025. So this is a hypothetical we're talking about here. You know, this isn't happening anytime soon. But at the same time, if you said, like, hey, what about Noah Schultz? What about, you know, Hagen Smith? What about Edgar Cuero, Kyle Teal, Braden Montgomery, Grant Taylor? If you said, who would you rather have as the cornerstone of a deal right now, Jeff, Grant Taylor or Colson Montgomery? And I know one is a pitcher with injury, you know, background and all that, but I can't imagine that Taylor's not on your ask list before Montgomery right now.
I think Caleb Bonimer might be on my ask.
100%.
At this point before him. So, you know,
like, might look at him as a reclamation project. They would look at him as a buy low candidate. We can fix him. The White Sox haven't been able to.
This might be blasphemous to some, but Chase Meidroth might be a better ask at this point than Colson Montgomery.
I would say, again, like, see, this is where, like, what I would say that Colson Montgomery doesn't mean he's no longer a prospect, but what he now fits into, like I said, it's the reclamation project, right? It's the guy that you're interested in as another organization, not as, like, as the cornerstone piece, but, like, he's a great number two piece. And if I'm the White Sox, to be honest, I'd be scared to death of dealing him in a trade like that, right? Because all that can happen out of that, you could say that you're selling before, you know, you're selling at not high, but you're selling before the spoil date on the milk, you know, like, hits. You're like, okay, there's 3 days left on this prospect status, we're going to sell now. but it's more like you're selling where if the new, if his new team can fix this, then you have to ask really hard questions of, well, why were they able to fix it and we weren't, right? Like, that's where this gets kind of challenging if you're a team. But, you know, obviously right now, the tough part of it is that it's like he does need some sort of reset. And it's hard to get that. Like, you kind of, as an organization to do that, you kind of have to rip the Band-Aid off and almost say, like, we know that there's something. Like, hey, you know, what we see, it's a tough road to follow, which is we're going to put him on the development list. We're going to work specifically on something and then bring him back. And he'll probably spend some time in extended complex like that. But the hope coming into the year was, is that last year was the blip, the aberration that he's coming back from. And you look at it now and you can't say that that was the blip. Right now, 2025 is showing that the problems of 2024 were a real problem that have to be fixed. And as you said, when you have the combination of he's choosing less strikes to swing at and having worse outcomes because of that, those are not easy problems to fix on the fly. We hope he turns around. We root for prospects, but
it's just unusual to see somebody who did something fairly well, even when he was struggling at a particular level, and just see the bottom absolutely fall out. So, it's his swing decisions look more like Benny Montgomery right now, and he does not have Benny's athleticism. So that's not good.
At WeWise, we help businesses across Europe turn cleaner energy into a competitive edge. In the UK, Centrico, part of the WeWise group, is a trusted expert in delivering solar energy systems, bringing tailored, high-quality installations for businesses like yours. Cut costs, reduce carbon, gain energy independence. Visit centrico.co.uk now and take charge of your energy future.
But, well, that's kind of our deep dive for today. But as we always do, we also now have our prospect soapbox. So today, I'll let you kind of start us off, Jeff. So who is the prospect? We do this every prospect podcast. And our one criteria is we're going to talk about a prospect we find interesting who is not currently on the top 100. We're digging a little deeper than that. Many would say that these are, you know, the prospects who are not talked about enough or whatever. We're not going to go there. They're all in our top 30s almost without fail. We write about them. We talk about them, but they're not top 100 prospects. So who do you have, Jeff, that you want to talk about this week?
Dayson Hill of the Twins. Left-hander. They drafted last year out of the Texas prep ranks in the, supplemental second round pick, if I'm not mistaken. 69th overall. Very nice. But 6'5", projectable, still pretty thin. Of course, the week that I was down in Florida, JJ, he was the one week he didn't pitch, but he's made three starts now, gotten into the fourth inning in all three starts. He has one that was four and then two that were three and a third, keeping him on a pretty low pitch count. But in total on the season, across 10 and two-thirds innings, he's allowed five hits, couple of runs, only one home run. He's walked four batters while striking out 21. And it's in the Florida State League. So you can go on to Savant, and, you know, if you pull out the little six-digit code, you can figure out how to look at the game feeds, and you can actually look at some of his games and take a look at his data. I will say that for sure, his four-seam fastball is marked as a sinker for some reason, and it is absolutely not a sinker. But it's really, really good stuff, JJ. Was up to 98.4 miles an hour on Saturday that he pitched against Clearwater. You know, we'll get up to like 18, 19, 20 inches of induced vertical break with double digit horizontal breaks. So it gets a lot of arm side run in addition to the ride. I do think that he does have a two seam variation that's more like 8 to 13 inches of induced with more horizontal. So he can kind of, I think, is important at this point in time. It's something we're seeing more and more of, is having two different fastball shapes just to navigate, you know, different handedness of batters, different styles of swings, and attacking guys. But, you know, he sits 95 to 97 miles an hour. As I said, has been up to 98, 99. I think there's more projection in the frame, so we might see a little bit more of that eventually. And I really just overall like the pitch mix, like his ability to attack and throw strikes, working both sides of the plate. It's a good changeup. It's a really good slider as well. He gets a ton of sweep on that thing. Mixes in a curveball that's got a little bit more two plane, a little bit more depth on it. That's more in like the high 70s versus low to mid 80s, like the slider is. So it's a good mix. I think it's still a pretty projectable frame. It's throwing a lot of strikes. The Twins have developed a lot of their pitching prospects pretty well in recent years, so I do think that they deserve some credit. They're not in the upper echelon, but you know, they've had some arms that have come up and found some success, and guys that are pretty interesting at this point in time. I'm sure you can speak on that more than me, as you cover the Twins yourself. But yeah, I think Dayson Hill is definitely one name that I'm going to be pushing for in top 100 conversations. It's a small sample size, but the stuff is just really good. Ben said it on the Hot Sheet show the other day. I do think that sometimes with pitchers early on in the season, it's very clear to see the strike throwing ability. It's clear to see the stuff. And especially when we have numbers like this that are publicly available on major league quality ball measuring devices. You know, I think
it's that's easier.
Yeah. It makes it a little bit easier 100% to kind of, you know, put it like to like to, you know, just how good some of the stuff is. So yeah. Dayson Hill is definitely one that, you know,
I like that you got him on your soapbox now, because he may not be eligible before too long to be part of our soapbox. As soon as he joins the top 100
now. Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. I've got a riddle that will start my prospect soapbox, which is, I'll ask you, Jeff. So like, if you said you were only allowed one stat, one piece of data, and you said, I'll make it very simple, that you said, okay, I want to predict who's going to be a future big leaguer anywhere in the minors, and you can only use one piece of information. So if you want batting average, you can have batting average. You want home run rate, you can have that. You want max EV, you want 90 if EV, you want 50 if EV, you want IVB, but you can only have one, you know, whatever you want. You can't have VAA and IVB. You can't have slugging and on base. You can't have walk and strikeout rate. Only one. What stat would you use?
And it's interesting, right? Because I think there's a bunch of production metrics that capture a bunch of different things for a hitter, like a WRC plus or something.
Plus, maybe, you know, that would be a good one.
But it's so often that if it's a single season, a smaller sample size, it's not over like a 3-year window, it's really hard to predict that that's sustainable, because there's plenty of guys that put up 140 WRC plus seasons in AA and then never sniff the major leagues or have very short.
AJ Reed, 185, I think it was, work plus in AA and AAA, and nope.
Yeah. Max Schrock was an excellent minor league hitter. You know, there's guys like that. I think, you know, I thought about it before the show, and I was like, maybe like really good pitch framing. Like if a guy is an elite pitch framer, do all those guys get to the major leagues? I think they all stick around in pro ball for a long time. I don't know if they all get to the major leagues. And I don't want to steal your thunder, but I do think the number that you're going to put out there,
I'll follow up and I'll agree with you, but you could use it.
Probably has the highest hit rate in terms of major leaguers, and that would be like elite velocity. I do think that, you know, if you see guys that throw 100 miles an hour, more often than not, if they can sustain that velocity consistently, even for a full inning, those guys get a shot in the majors. Even the worst ones get a shot in the majors, because I could say EV, I could say barrel rate, but there's contact, there's swing decisions. You have to have one of those for it to work, that I really don't feel like I can boil hitting down to one. And as I mentioned, we have guys that do put up sort of, mirage WRC plus and OPS sort of numbers too.
So that's where I was going to go, which is there's people who are going to hear me say this and they're going to get very annoyed by it. But if you said, I can only have one stat and I want to know who's going to become a future big leaguer, who's at any level of the minors, right? Anywhere, rookie ball up to triple A. If they have truly elite velocity, doesn't mean they're going to be a great big leaguer, but they're going to probably be a big leaguer. And that's my soapbox today. Mets right-hander Ramon Gomez touched 104.5 miles an hour. And not only that, not just touched that, but kind of sat 101, 102, had multiple pitches over 103 miles an hour for low A St. Lucie this past week. You and I both wrote about him in our Rule 5 preview because he was available. And we were like, hey, he's coming off of TJ, but there's a big arm here. The arm's even a little bit bigger than we thought. But I focus on that because when you say a guy throws 104.5, that one piece of information tells me big leaguer. And I know that some are going to hear that and say, that's not true at all. You don't know if he's going to throw strikes. You don't know if he's going to get hurt. You don't know all these things. But we've been studying this now at Baseball America for quite a while, right? Like, we have compiled simple list of here's every minor leaguer who threw 100 miles an hour. We did it in 14. I'm having trouble finding that story, but we did it in 16. We did it in 18. And let me just kind of throw these numbers out. We have all this over at baseballamerica.com, but I'll give you a little snippet of it, which is we had 71 pitchers who threw 100 miles an hour in the minors in 2016. And 66% of those went on to pitch in the majors, which, okay, 66%. That's a high number, but there were 23 of them who threw 101. 74% of those made the majors, so the rate went up. And there were 11 who touched 102 that year. And of those 11, 10 pitched in the majors. So 91% pitched in the majors. Okay, so you're like, those are good numbers. Well, what about this? In 2018, when we studied this, we had 77 pitchers. We didn't delineate that year between 100, 101, 102, 103. We just said, here are all the guys we have who threw 100. Of those 77, 68, that's 88%, went on to pitch in the majors. Some of them were really good. Some of them had cups of coffee. But the key distinction is what I love about this stat, what I love about pointing out about this is that we're not controlling for anything here, right? Ray Black, who I loved watching Ray Black pitch, but Ray Black probably had three stretches over a 10-year span where he was healthy for 4 months in a row, right? Like, injuries, we're not delineating for those. If a guy was just healthy for a week, but he threw 100, he's on the list. Control problems, we're not controlling for that. Like, if a guy walked if he was Steve Dalkowski, if he hit everyone, including the bull, still on this list. And so you say, like, okay, so how did that higher rate make it? I think the key thing is your margin of error, your allowance of what teams will allow you to do and keep you coming back. If you throw 100, especially 101, 102, you get chances to solve all those things that you don't if you throw 95, right? Like, if you're 95 and you have control troubles, you're probably at some point they're going to go, okay, it's not working with this guy, on to the next one. If you throw 90 and you run into, you know, like, you're just getting hammered, on to the next guy. But if you throw 102, well, 102 has a quality all its own where if you're anywhere around the zone, even if you're not, they're probably going to bring you back for another year and say, maybe we can figure it out next year. You have examples of this, you know, kind of year after year. The other thing I would point out with that is so again, I'll finish it with one more stat, which is we also studied this for the 102 mile an hour club from 2021 to 2025. And yes, we've raised the bar because now 100 miles an hour is a little bit pedestrian now in pro ball. But 102, and Ramon Gomez is very much a member of the 102 club. We found 31 pitchers, including Gomez, who've thrown 102. And the vast majority of them, we have 21 of those who've pitched in the majors so far. And you say, okay, so that leaves 10 others. Six of those 10 are top 30 prospects right now who are expected to pitch in the majors. Like, you've got guys like Luis May, Zach Maxwell, Reynaldo Ying, guys who They're just on their way up. They haven't had a chance to get there yet, but we expect that they'll get there. And when you say, okay, what are those guys like? Well, that's Yoan Duran, that's Mason Miller, that's Felix Bautista, that's Camilo Doval. And the one that I kind of want to, you know, kind of emphasize here to just illustrate what I'm talking about is Justin Martinez. If you take a look at Justin Martinez's 2023 season and you said, this guy's going to be a closer in 2 years, you'd have never believed it. He walked a batter an inning in AAA and the majors that year. He had an ERA over 10 in the major leagues that year. And you say, okay, if that guy threw 95, it'd have been like, well, moving on. But Justin, you know, he doesn't throw 95. He throws 102. Got another opportunity. Had a much better year last year, threw a lot more strikes. This year, he's their closer. So, yes, I would say with Ramon Gomez, I feel extremely confident in saying he may be in low A, but that's a big leaguer. And I wouldn't be shocked at all if he was a big leaguer by the end of this year. He was sent back to low A in part coming off of Tommy John surgery. Insert your, you know, he throws 102, he has Tommy John, but he's coming off Tommy John surgery. But so they're kind of slow playing him a little bit. He had made it to high A before he had Tommy John surgery. I'd expect he'll go there before too long. It's warming up. But if you said that he ends up on kind of an Edgardo, you know, Enriquez kind of track like we saw last year, started the year in low A, then went to high A, then went to double A, then went to triple A, and turn around, he's in the big leagues in September, wouldn't be shocked at all. And that's why Ramon Gomez is my prospect soapbox of this week. And one of my other soapboxes, which is I love to talk about how velocity is still, at the end of the day, one of the most important things you can have. It is the most important thing you can have as a pitcher. I know that we can, you know, laud guys who hit corners and locate. And I'm not saying there are not many other aspects to pitching, but if you throw 104, you're probably going to have some success, because even hitters who are gotten used to velocity, they don't want to see 104. It changes everything else. But go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, and I was going to say the other thing too is I think it's also different kinds of conversations, like who's going to be a starter versus who's going to be in the majors and have a career. Two different conversations. And, you know, if you want to have that conversation about starters, sure. Though, if you sit 96 plus as a starter, righty or lefty, particularly left-handed, you have a very good chance of starting if you throw just enough strikes. And that's kind of what it is with the relievers, you know? So I think some people don't necessarily like break up the conversation into the, because it's just this, like pitchers, it's like this big giant, you know, category that has all these subcategories. We're really like with hitters, you're still playing a position most of the time, you're still facing the same kind of pitching where, you know, how you get there as a starter or a reliever, the job is a little different. So I think if you're talking big leaguers though, velocity is going to get you there, whether it's as a reliever. And there's more and more guys that got those opportunities as relievers that when they're 27, 28, all of a sudden do sometimes get an opportunity to start. We're seeing it a lot more often of, you know, relievers that have three or four pitches being converted into starters. Clay Holmes, primary example. And I guess Crochet as well, but trajectory was a little different.
But I would say, like with that, like to take the example, like the extreme example, this would be the Rays Mason Montgomery, who had kind of been the starter who always had a question about whether the mix was enough to be a starter long-term. And so at this time last year, Mason Montgomery was a starter who was sitting 92, 94 in AAA and getting kind of beat up regularly for AAA Durham. And eventually they decided last year to move him to the pen. Immediately the velo ticks up to 97, 98. Well, then he comes to the offseason. He's got a full offseason. It's like, you're just going to be a fire-breathing monster of a reliever this year. Now he's touching 102. And all of a sudden you're talking about a whole different pitcher. Now, I think, Jeff, you made a great point there. There are pitchers who fit this. Hunter Green was on that group. Joe Boyle, Paul Skeens has touched 102, guys like that. Bubba Chandler is a guy who's touched 101 this year. Being able to do that as a starter is a really useful trait as well. But especially the key thing about this is a lot of these guys are guys who, yeah, when you're a reliever, a lot of these guys, there's this incredible mass of reliever candidates at high A, double A, triple A. And there are like five candidates, because you throw many of the starters at those levels into that group for every job that comes open at the big league level. And one of the ways to differentiate yourself is that if you throw 101, 102, they're probably going to figure out a way that you're useful in some way, shape, or form at the big league level. If you have the best changeup, the best slider, you know, the best screwball, whatever it is, you can also make it, you know, do it that way. But if you said, like, hey, how do I differentiate myself? A guy like Mason Montgomery goes from being, I don't know what this guy is as a starter, to being, oh, he's going to be a key part of their bullpen in the span of just a couple of months by basically saying, hey, by the way, if you put me in the pen, I throw 100. That makes a big difference. But so before we wrap up, anything else, or what is your to-do list look like this week? What are you looking forward to watching this week, Jeff?
Lots of minor league games on MILB TV. I've really gotten comfortable with that. I might shoot up to New Hampshire and go see Portland. Don't have Worcester locally this week. So, we'll see. You know, we'll see where I end up going this week. I might be taking it easy and then, you know, maybe trip it out in the next week or two. But got Little League Baseball kicking off. We got opening day on Saturday. We got lacrosse going, softball. First game of the season tonight for my daughter. So got lots of sports, you know, my daughter and my youngest son are both playing lax and baseball, softball. So I got a lot going on right now.
I think my week, I'm hoping to see, as we record this, Briggs McKenzie tonight, one of the better high school pitching prospects in the country. So that'll be a fun night. Joe Mack is in with Jacksonville playing Durham. So I'm going to get my first chance to hopefully see in person our new top 100 prospect, catching prospect, Joe Mack. And maybe I haven't made it out to Zebulon yet. Got to get out there sometime soon to see the, what we've described as the most exciting team in the minor league. So hopefully a very busy, fun week for me as well. As again, a reminder, thank you for anyone who has subscribed, but please like and subscribe. Helps other people in addition to making sure that you get every one of our videos or podcast. Do check out all the stuff we have over at baseballamerica.com. Ton of great stuff this week, as there is every week. I would highlight, we had a staff draft for if you're interested in draft prospects. We have, you know, our hot sheet every week. I would say it was a very star-studded hot sheet this week, and we are updating our draft draft rankings to go to 400 now, writings with rankings and reports. And by the way, coming up real soon, we will have a top 100 prospects update, a real one in season, not just graduations, but like, hey, we're moving guys based on feedback, based on what we're hearing. So for Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.
At WeWise, we help businesses across Europe turn cleaner energy into a competitive edge. In the UK, Centrico, part of the WeWise Group, is a trusted expert in delivering solar energy systems, bringing tailored, high-quality installations for businesses like yours. Cut costs, reduce carbon, gain energy independence. Visit centrico.co.uk now and take charge of your energy future.